There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our roundup of the best bits from the show on Monday.
The National Football League welcomes you to the Pepsi Super Bowl 54 Halftime Show.
Yes, it is the Super Bowl. We have been crunching the numbers to look at its economic impact. 194 million people estimated to have watched the game in the early hours of this morning, 17 million of which are expected to call in sick to work in the US for Monday. $17.2 billion spent by people watching the game at home, 80% of that on F and B. It's thought that it will generate $500 million for the Miami area where it's being held, although a lot of economists contest that and say, A, it's very hard to get the real number, and B, you can't see the money that isn't being spent by the people who are staying away because of the Super Bowl. But we've had a try this morning. We've had a try to figure out the economic impact of the Super Bowl. Everything from sponsorship to hotel rooms to discretionary spending. Steve Bainbridge is a partner and the head of sports and events management at the law firm Al Tamimi & Co. And we spoke to him this morning about the business of the advertising, because here's what's interesting. The number of people watching the Super Bowl is declining year on year. 2015, there was roughly 114 million and a half people watching, 114. 2019, there was 98 million people watching, so a drop of around 16 million people. And yet in the same time period, the cost of a 30-second ad spot has gone up from 4.5 million to 5.4 million. So we said to Steve, how does that work?
Well, look, absolutely, it is going up. And I think also it's important to point out, too, that those advertising slots are normally sold over a year in advance. So I think that they were locked in probably in November the previous year. But as you say, really, if we look at these changes in viewing numbers, they're perhaps incremental. There's been a lot of talk about the NFL waxing and waning. Certainly it's had some problems in terms of its image and tie-ins with political issues. But I would also suggest during that time period, you're still looking at roughly a third of the population in the U.S. tuning in. And we also have a broader global audience, which seems to be growing every year, just as I'm sure many people today will have been watching this morning at ridiculous hours in Dubai.
And we also asked him about how much of an economic coup really is holding such a sporting event, because we were interested to try and find out what Dubai could learn from this. We have a major international spectacle coming up ourselves. What are the lessons?
I think that the question is here, how long is a piece of string? And you'll have your micro and your macro analysis. I know that the most recent statistics from last year in Atlanta, we were looking at between 45 and 50 million was the cost to the city perceived to essentially host it, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of additional security, healthcare facilities, road closures, that sort of thing. But it was also estimated that 10 times the cost was the value. So you're looking at there last year and close to half a billion. And I think those figures obviously can be argued. And as you mentioned before the break as well, it may not necessarily be that a lot of the revenues coming in are actually dispersed in the community. Typically, you'll see the uptake in footfall, your restaurants, your hospitality, your hotels, that sort of thing. But increasingly, that may be diverted away from the community through vehicles such as Airbnb, where you may have absentee landlords in certain areas, essentially taking profits away from the community. But I think there still is a perception that you're looking at about 10x of your costs when you host an event such as that. And it will vary, of course. When we're looking at the Super Bowl, we're talking about what's become a one-week event. Others will be very different. And especially as you mentioned Expo, we're looking at essentially 6 months of a daily event. So it could be a very different dynamic when we analyze the numbers locally for the impact of Expo 2020.
And that is Steve Bainbridge, partner, head of sports and events management at the law firm Al Tamimi.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Maurice Gravier is with us in the studio, Chief Investment Officer, Emirates NBD. Morning, Maurice.
Good morning.
Your new global investment outlook is out, and we'll get to that in a second, but have to begin by asking you about live trading in Asia right now. Chinese markets reopened after the New Year break about an hour ago, and there was a sharp sell-off, Shanghai down more than 7% this morning. How significant is the coronavirus in terms of markets over the medium and long term?
Of course, coronavirus was one of these unexpected events that happens, and it has an impact. There's no question. This virus has a couple of singularities. First, and the most worrying, is that it's spreading very quickly. There is a kind of a hyperbolic spread, which means that we will have probably more cases and more news flow in that area. So the second differentiating factor, probably with others, is the magnitude of the responses from the Chinese authorities, you know, and in particular, lockdown of entire areas and closing factories. And this is big, and not even talking about flights being cut and this kind of thing. So looking at impact, there will be an economic impact. The key question is that will it be just a demand shock, which already happens because people have not traveled because of the fear factor, or will there be a supply shock? Because China is not just another country; it's the largest exporter in the world, and if factories don't reopen at a point in the global supply chain, it might have an impact. This is for the economic impact. We are in the camp of, you know, not really optimism, but we look at the mortality rates, and at a point there will be an inflection in the spreading, and at a point factories will reopen and things could be okay. So our scenario currently is that there will be a Q1 shock. For sure, China is affected a lot in Q1. Tourism is affected, luxury goods is affected, but we hope that if factories reopen in February, there won't be a global shock, and at the end we could bounce. Market reaction looks honestly a bit like an overreaction. It looks like it's pricing the worst case scenario.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's look at the long term, because your global investment outlook doesn't look at this week and next week. It takes a long term outlook. And your long term outlook, I have to say, is not particularly optimistic. You say that investors have to get used to modest returns in 2020. Last year, gangbusters on US stock markets, 30% increase. You say that's not going to happen again this year. Why not?
Yeah, there are clear differences between last year and this year. And some are a bit paradoxical. Last year, we had a slowing economy and lots of uncertainties, especially trade war, Brexit, you know, you name it, a lot of that. So it was not a very good backdrop picture, but valuations were reasonable at the beginning of the year, and investors were very pessimistic. That's why we turned constructive last year, and we were lucky because it even exceeded our positive expectations because of the Fed cutting rates, which was not expected, and it took pessimistic investors by surprise. This year, we should have an improving global economy, unless the coronavirus lasts 6 months and really takes a toll, but we should have an improving economy. But valuations are super expensive, especially in developed markets, and investors are not as defensively positioned as they were. So you don't have this support from flows. So at the end, we say asset markets should deliver returns in line with the nominal GDP growth, more or less. You know, bonds will pay their coupons, stock will pay their dividend. We favor high dividend stocks in developed markets because they are too expensive. So just take the dividends, and we favor emerging markets, which is more of a long-term call. And
which emerging markets in particular do you like? If you could pick a couple of countries.
I might surprise you. We wrote that before the coronavirus, but China definitely. China, among others, I would say emerging Asia. If we talk about stocks, because again, we like emerging markets in both fixed income and equities. For fixed income, we like our region. For example, the GCC. You have excellent risk-adjusted returns. I mean, you have very high ratings, high quality of credit, especially from sovereign, and you get some coupons. So in fixed income, we like the region, Asia as well. Asia high yield, much better than US high yield, which gives you nothing for a high risk. And for stocks, yes, we like China. I know that so far it's very difficult. It's the worst performing market, but think about the size of China now in the economy, and the size of China in portfolios. And
Warren Buffett said, be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy. Chinese stocks are 10% cheaper today than they were 10 days ago. And you think the fundamentals are still strong?
The fundamentals are strong over the long term. There's no question about the growth differential, and there is also the valuation gap, which was already, before what happened this morning and what happened in the last month, the valuation gap was already very big. We have titled our publication Back to Reality. It's very simple. You have faster growth, cheaper valuation, and people are not invested. So what you need is a catalyst. Currently, we have a negative catalyst. If anything, if we go 10% lower, it would be a buying opportunity because a virus is terrible from a human point of view or whatever. But unless you think it's there forever, it doesn't do structural damage. So at a point, things bounce back.
I'm having a look at your notes from this report, and you're quite down on the old ETF, the exchange traded fund, which is something that a lot of expats will have invested in, thinking that they're doing the safe thing, the rising tide, you know, helps all boats type of thing. Why is this?
These expats and all the people who have invested in ETFs have been absolutely right. ETFs have done very well because we were in macro-driven beta market. It was about, the Fed, the growth. And in this case, indices jump and ETFs are cheaper as well. You have lower management fees, so it's a better return at the end. What we say now, it's again this back to reality, is that we won't have this big beta movement, not this year. We think we will have positive but modest returns. It means that the ability to select the best players should make bigger difference comparatively. Honestly, last year, if you had an ETF on the S&P 500, you had 28%. Why bothering trying to get 29 with an active manager who takes anyway 1 or 2% of management fees? This year, it could be different because we are... Look at US market. You were mentioning Amazon. Look at US market this year. It's interesting. The markets are diverging. Technology stocks are doing better because they have better results. You know, you see this selectivity trying to beginning to play out, and we think it's a theme for the future. Yeah.
So finally, if we look at some of the other asset classes we can invest in, commodities front and center here in the UAE, oil and gold. A lot of people like it here in the UAE. What are your thoughts on those assets?
We for all asset classes, the way we do is that we calculate fair values for the end of the year, where we think the asset should trade. And for gold, our fair value is $1,550 an ounce, and this is where we are now. So we are neutral on gold because we have already reached our fair value. Our fair value is based on US real yield. It's difficult to put a fair value on gold. You don't have cash flow to discount. For oil, our fair value is 57, and we are close to that as well. But the point...
20 seconds left, the US dollar, and by extension, the dirham. Massively important for us. Higher, lower, or about the same in 2020.
Well, the US dollar is complicated. It's the reserve currency of the world, and it has also some kind of risk-off, risk-on component. What we can say is that US dollar compared to emerging market currencies as a group is too strong, and it's part of our call on emerging markets. We think it's too strong. If we look at, Europe, GBP or Euro with the Brexit...
Is Europe an emerging market now, as a Frenchman? You don't have to answer that.
I'm afraid we might become one.
Maurice, we'll have to leave it there. Great fun talking to you. Appreciate your time today. Maurice Gravier is Chief Investment Officer at Emirates NBD. Thanks for sharing the findings from your investment outlook with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
And with us to go through the big stories, Natasha Thomas from the ARN News Centre. Morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Richard.
Let's start with some of the big stories that you are covering today. On the ARN News Centre app, been reading about, for example, the updates on emergency roadworks in the JLT area.
Yes, so if you were among the drivers stuck in unusually heavy traffic in Dubai's Jumeirah Lake Towers over the past 2 days, then you'll be happy to know that emergency road maintenance works that were holding up traffic in the area have now been completed. Now, temporarily, there were diversions put in place over the weekend to fix a faulty pipe. Many motorists had, in fact, texted us into the studio describing how they had been stuck in the area for up to 2 hours, even on Saturday. The Roads and Transport Authority had to basically make a new road because this pipe burst. There was a lot of water in the area.
They had to make a new road?
Pretty much. That's exactly what was told to us, because that whole area, the road had caved in, so they had to fix all that. And obviously that took time. Yesterday, we spoke to Adil Al-Marzouki, who is the director of the RTA's Right of Way Department. And this is what he told us.
The pipe rectification work was completed on the evening of the 1st of February and the site was handed over to RTA for asphalt reinstatement. Right now, works are in progress by RTA and all stages will be completed by tomorrow, 3rd of February, early morning, inshallah.
And as promised there, authorities have confirmed that all the lanes are now functional.
Now, let's talk about Sheikh Mohammed, the ruler of Dubai, honouring school worker for inspiring students.
Yes, so this Emirati social worker has been honoured with the Prime Minister's Medal for spreading positive energy and happiness among school students. We all have that colleague, you know, who when you walk into the office, you look forward to seeing that person because they're always smiling, always positive. And this particular individual now, a few days ago, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the Vice President and Prime Minister of the UAE and ruler of Dubai, posted a video on his Instagram account. It shows this teacher greeting pupils at her school in Al Ain with a kiss and a hug as they walk in early in the morning. So he had called out to his Twitter followers and to his social media followers to help find this woman. And of course, she's been found. Her name is Sheikha Al-Noemi. Both Sheikha and her mother were given the Prime Minister's medal during the weekly cabinet meeting on Sunday. His Highness said that she's a positive example among the many role models in our country who inspire others with their energy and accomplishments. She's a positive and proactive employee who basically exceeds the limits of her job to make others happy. And he said it's important that government employees especially have that culture of affirmative action. You know, they transfer their happiness to customers as well.
Who would it be here? I'm going to vote for Danny Norton in the ARN News Centre. One of those people, you walk in and they just smile.
Yes.
And they're just nice. They haven't got a bad bone in their body. Danny Norton takes that box.
I would agree there. Yes, absolutely. Danny's always smiling.
I know what you mean because I always envy those people. I think, how do you have this sunny disposition in which just everyone likes you and you like all people? Because let's be fair, no one's voting for me for this particular category. I think we can argue that that's the place. No, it has to be Danny. The vegan wins.
He's probably Dexter at weekends. But in the office, you couldn't meet a nicer guy.
He murders plants.
Of course he's vegan, yes. Finally, tell us about this tribute to Kobe Bryant that we had at the Burj Khalifa yesterday.
Yes, so the world's tallest tower, the Burj Khalifa, lit up in tribute to NBA legend Kobe Bryant last night. The special display, which featured an image of Kobe and his daughter Gianna, was arranged by Ahmed Bin Salem, the executive chairman of Dubai Multi-Commodities Centre. Now, the prominent Emirati businessman had been a longtime friend and fan of the late basketball star, who died last week in a helicopter crash along with his daughter. If you remember, he had also hosted Kobe in Dubai in September 2013 during his visit to the UAE. And that's why this was his way of paying tribute.
Brandy's presenter's pick would be of great interest to the aforementioned Danny Norton.
She said she was vegan, 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 just to get with me.
But we now have a way to figure out if she's lying.
Go on.
Because the British Retail Consortium have come up with a standard, a badge, if you like, a sticker for products that are free of animal products. If you think of probably the best known as the Vegetarian Society has its stamp that it puts on things, right? Or in America, the Heart Foundation sticks a stamp on foodstuffs that meet their guidelines. This is not for foodstuffs, though, and that's what's interesting about it, because we know that plant-based food, plant-based eating has absolutely taken off in the last year and a half. Fun fact, in the UK, 1 in 5, so 20% of all new grocery products that were launched last year were plant-based, were vegan. Huge growing sector. The clothing and accessories market is lagging behind, and yet the studies show that there is a demand for it, particularly amongst younger shoppers. Here's a survey from Mintel research firm. They say that 2/3, so around 66%, of 16 to 24-year-old shoppers want to buy more ethical fashion. And it's a greater proportion than the whole of all age groups. How do you know that what you're getting is what you're actually getting is the question? Because it's not just a case of, okay, that's a leather handbag, that's not a leather handbag. Things like dyes are made out of crushed beetles. A lot of glue is made out of cartilagey bits that people don't like to think about. So it's making sure that the entire chain is vegan, and they have come out effectively with the guidelines, the standards, and then you will get the tick, the vegan tick, if you like. It's partly to help those who want to make the right decisions, but I would argue that it is also a mammoth sales tool.
Well, and we were talking about this earlier because I was in a car showroom over the weekend looking at getting a new car. And one of the posh car showrooms, and they were selling as a virtue the fact that the seats weren't leather, they were vegan leather.
Otherwise known as fake leather.
It's
leather.
But you just put the word vegan leather on it and suddenly fake leather sounds exotic and cool.
Yeah, it's no longer plastic.
Rather than a cheap plastic alternative, which is basically what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sales tool. Let's call it what it is. I mean, it's good if you are the sort of person that, you know, that you will buy according to your ethics, and good for you if so. It will absolutely definitely help people make choice. But I would imagine that it will help people make the choice who are sitting on the fence or who just want to, you know, shop a little better, behave a little better, whichever it is. Would it influence your buying decisions, do you think?
Well, it has influenced my eating decisions. Slowly but surely, I find myself eating more vegan food. This morning I said, and I've come to work with a vegan salad. It turns out it had shredded chicken on it, so I'm quite past that
It was
test,
a vegan chicken.
But it absolutely wasn't. But I am definitely eating more vegan and plant-based food, partly because it's good for you, partly because I buy into this argument that for the planet, we've got to stop eating. We've got to eat less meat. And partly because it's cheaper, and you throw in
you
a fourth reason.
It's a huge amount cheaper.
But it's tasty. Mm. And I just find myself craving it more and more. When I go out, I find myself ordering vegetarian or vegan food.
Is it cheaper, though? Because I come across so many vegan restaurants here, and when you want to order in, I find their rates are quite pretty much the same or
supermarket-wise. Yeah. Supermarket-wise, it's massively cheaper if you're not buying meat or
but yeah,
fish.
If you're on Deliveroo, Big Mac and fries is going to be half
Five
the price
dirhams
of something
or whatever
vegan.
It is at the moment. Yeah, absolutely. That's a whole other conversation.
Natasha Thomas from the Area News Centre. Good to have you with us. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Talking scooters now on the Business Breakfast.
We are indeed. Abu Dhabi e-scooter provider Circ has been bought by California rival Bird. What does that mean for getting around the capital? We're very pleased to be joined in the studio now by Bada Al-Khalouti, who is the co-founder and CEO of Circ in this region. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us about this acquisition. Why has Bird bought Circ, and why did Circ want to be bought by Bird?
Good question. There was a very clear win-win proposition for both companies from this transaction. I think we both shared the same vision for micromobility. We had very similar corporate ethos. If you look at Bird specifically, over the last year, they've prioritized unit economics over growth and have focused instead on their U.S. markets and North American region. Circ, on the other hand, was doing a phenomenal job last year growing across Europe and the Middle East, and also placed a focus on unit economics as opposed to that land grab. So when it came time for Bird to expand to the Europe and Middle East region, we were the logical choice. And together, we're now one of the leading global companies in the space, and we have identified a clearer path to profitability.
Does this industry need consolidation?
Yes, it definitely does. Every industry needs consolidation, right? So, you know, once you start out, you obviously have the product market fit, the whole euphoria around the product happened and people were very excited and the proof of concept was clearly there. Everyone kind of rushed in to try and set up a scooter company overnight. But what you don't realize is that in this business, it's you know, you have to have the capital to do it properly and you have to have the long-term view and operational intensity to really provide a good, safe service, right? And so throughout that journey, there's going to be a lot of companies that either fizzle out or end up merging to become bigger and stronger.
Why doesn't Bird just enter the region and try and starve you out?
Oh, because it's always easier to kind of pick off the leading operator in a given region, right? And for us, we've done a great job over the last year building that base in the region and building that playbook out of the UAE to expand beyond UAE. And so obviously that comes with, you know, great team building, which is not so easy to do. You know, we've built a great brand with the customers here. We've had phenomenal traction. You know, the fleet has been very well maintained and the ops that we've developed here for this region is hard to replicate. And so for Bird, it made a lot of sense if the Middle East was of interest, and it is of interest. And that was something that was, for me personally, quite comforting post the transaction, is that we both realized the A, traction that we've done here in the region, and B, validates the potential we both see going forward for the Middle East.
What will it allow you to do that you couldn't do before? What changes will happen?
Yeah, so with these kind of things, there's always, you can always get better as a company when you bring two leading operators together. And, you know, there's multiple fronts where that can happen. So for us, it'd be, you know, picking off some of the technology that Bird had, you know, that maybe we didn't have at CERC, you know, and that includes things like a government portal, which allows the regulators to kind of have access to our technology platform for them to monitor the scooter industry, their access to capital. You know, we're probably now the most funded, most well-funded scooter company in the world. So, you know, these things go a long way.
Do you have any agreements in terms of sort of protecting your people and headcount? I'm saying that because obviously we saw the Uber Kareem deal get its final sign-offs, and then within about 3 weeks we saw layoffs and redeployments at Kareem.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's going to be a process, and it's quite normal with these kind of acquisitions that, you know, they're going to evaluate, optimize and rationalize where it makes sense, right? So, and it'll be a case by case for each market. As of now, I think they've made it quite clear that they want to try and retain as many CERC employees as possible, specifically where there are areas of overlap. But in the Middle East, as of now, you know, obviously Bird wasn't here before, so, you know, we're pretty okay here, and I think we're going to continue to grow the team as we expand in the region.
Oh, you're competing with Lime in Abu Dhabi, obviously. How's this going to help you to do that?
Again, you know, obviously we were going to have a superior, in my opinion, advantage in the fact that, you know, we're going to have provide multiple models in terms of how we operate our fleet across the region. So it's not just necessarily a cookie cutter approach anymore. We can have the flexibility to utilize different models for different markets across the region.
Well, speaking of different markets, let's talk about Dubai. I presume that you are talking to the RTA here, to the regulators here. Where are we in terms of getting e-scooters?
Yeah, so everyone's excited about this, and I think it's still a work in progress, but there's been clear indication that the wheels are moving, and you know what they say is the inshallah is going to hold true this year, I think, in my personal opinion, and we should expect it to come online, I think, say Q2, Q3 this year. You know, we're all very excited for it.
What's the in the discussions that you're having with the regulator here, what are their concerns? Why is Dubai holding back a little bit on this?
Yeah, look, I definitely got to tip my hat off to the regulator here, because it's you know, this industry obviously is in the spotlight these days, and you have to take a kind of prudent and cautious approach. And what I admired about Dubai is that they sat back, looked at what's happening around the world, and cherry picked the best practices from each of the markets, you know, whether from Americas, Europe, or Middle East, Asia. And I think they've kind of figured out, this is the right formula for success when you want to roll out micromobility in Dubai. And I think, you know, taking that time is a good approach for the safety of everyone.
How confident are you that when we do allow e-scooters back here on the streets, that you will be the company or one of the companies to do that?
I'm pretty confident. And the reason being is, you know, we've had a great success in Abu Dhabi. We've, you know, done over 300,000 plus rides in this short span of 5 months. We're the clear leader in Abu Dhabi, and that's a testament to our operational standards. I mean, we've had, you know, almost a couple incidents for that ratio of rides, which is a phenomenal achievement. And then again, you know, obviously we have done quite a few things in terms of, you know, partnerships and in terms of how we prioritize safety. So I think, you know, that's going to go a long way when the RTA evaluates operators.
And Badr Al-Khalouti, co-founder and CEO of CERC for this region, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.